So let's start the debate and arguing for the proposition. David Frum, please take the podium.
Thank you. Thank you all, and thank you to the Rosenkranz Foundation for their important work in making civil conversation really a reality in which we can all participate. I'd like to tell you a little story to begin. About 2 months after I started work at the White House in 2001, there was a rap on the door, not a midnight rap, a daytime rap. My wife went to answer the door, and there on the step was an agent of the FBI. He showed her his badge and asked if he might come in and ask a few questions. Our next-door neighbor, he told her, had just been hired into a sensitive position in the federal government, and as part of the security check on the next-door neighbor, he wanted to ask a few questions. So he asked my wife, had we noticed anything unusual about them? Did they seem to be living within their means? Did they conduct themselves responsibly and respectably in the neighborhood? And she's a little embarrassed because these were new neighbors. We did not know them well, but to the best of her ability, she gave them a clean bill of health. But jogged by this, she said, you know, we haven't had them over when we really should. So she invited the next-door neighbors over a few weeks later, and they came, and we poured tea and gave them cake, and eventually my wife congratulated them on the husband's new job with the federal government. He said, what are you talking about? He said, I'm still at Sidley and Austin. I've always been at Sidley and Austin. And what we realized was the FBI had meant to come to their house to ask them about me. Tonight's motion is better, more domestic surveillance than another 9/11. And the question is, more than what? And my answer is, more than that. Now, none of us are here to argue. None of us are here to argue for limitless domestic surveillance. The three of us on the affirmative side of this debate have a deep and abiding commitment to privacy and liberty. My colleague, Andy McCarthy, has been a federal prosecutor. His job is to defend and uphold the U.S. Constitution, the greatest liberty-affirming document in world history. My colleague, John Yoo, was on the front line to defend all of our liberties and the liberties of people all over the world against a totalitarian conspiracy. Not only that, but in our private lives, Annie McCarthy is a conservative in New York, and John Yoo is a conservative at Berkeley, California. We understand, believe me, in the most intimate possible way, the importance of free thought, free expression, privacy, and the ability of human beings to speak their mind in debate and conversation without fear of punishment or consequence or an overbearing state. But here's the question for today. Should we have more surveillance than we had when those FBI agents were knocking on the wrong door? A level of surveillance that made possible the tremendous catastrophe we know as 9/11? Or should we continue with the path we've been following since 9/11 toward not a police state, not a nightmare regime in which you have no privacy? Is anyone in this room, as a concrete matter, afraid to speak his or her mind? I very much doubt it. But that's just because your listeners are so cranky. We are here to uphold a new level of surveillance that is not made up of new techniques, that is made up of very familiar and traditional techniques, as my partners will argue, that is not onerous, that is not burdensome, that leaves all legitimate freedoms and privacies intact, and that is abundantly worth it, and in fact has proven over the past half decade, has proven in the acid test of experience its merit. You know, 9/11 is beginning to be a little while ago, but the recent terrible events at Virginia Tech Technical Institute, Virginia Tech University, remind us of the reality of danger and fear that we all experienced in those terrible days. Now, if we cast our minds back to that time, I think many of us will remember we expected more of the same. We dreaded more of the same. And that was one of the reasons that the sniper attacks in Washington were able to paralyze a great city, because we were ready for something dreadful, something even more dreadful. And on American soil, it has not happened. But that does not mean that the threat is not real. In fact, if you sound the roll of world events since 9/11, you will be reminded how very, very real it is. In December of 2001,
gunmen attacked the Indian Parliament and attempted, hoped to kill, in fact, very senior officials in the Indian government. They did kill a number of parliamentarians and some civil servants and some security guards, and very nearly succeeded in triggering a nuclear war between India and Pakistan. We remember the bombing in Bali, which took so many lives of Indonesians and Australians and others who are visiting that beautiful place. The Madrid Atocha railway station bombings. The bombings in London in 2005. Just this past year, in 2006, attempted bombings, very serious attempted bombings, in Toronto and in Germany, and tragically a successful bombing in Bombay, successful, of course, from the point of view of the terrorists. The threat of mass casualty terrorism at the hands of people guided by a totalitarian ideology remains a real threat. But here's the good news. What we notice as we look back on this half decade of terrible atrocities is a dwindling level of sophistication behind each of these attempts. That the Atocha attack was much less sophisticated than the 9/11 attack, the London attack in 2005 less sophisticated than Atocha, and the attacks attempted this past summer were less sophisticated than those of 2005. The terrorists are finding it harder to coordinate, they're finding it harder to communicate with each other, they are under crushing international pressure. Now, one of the ironies about this is we don't entirely understand how this is happening, even inside our own law enforcement agencies. Here's one way to think about how a terrorist attack proceeds. If any of you have been in a toy store recently, I'm sure you've seen those toys where you drop a ball bearing into a little slot, and it whizzes and rolls, and it catches a little teeter-totter, and it goes through a basketball hoop, and it proceeds over many feet of tracking until finally it emerges out the other end. And there are a series all along the way of little switching points, and that's the game, to watch the ball jump and hop and skip and move past these various obstacles. Think of a terrorist plot as like that ball bearing. It starts, and it rolls, and it unfurls. And it has to pass through a number of switching points. If you can make each of those points just slightly more difficult, you stop the plot in just the way that Earth's atmosphere stops the meteorites without any of us ever being aware of it. It is that level of intensified surveillance of illegitimate activities that has complicated the life of the terrorists and has not made terrorism impossible, has not in any way lessened their desire to do people harm. But that has made, that has broken up their ability to communicate with one another, that has made it more difficult for them to move money, and has made it much more difficult for them to strike, and especially to strike inside the United States. You know, all of us here are people who love liberty, who prize liberty, and who use liberty as we are using it tonight. But we are also citizens of great cities in the Western world, and we are all potential casualties of attack. And the liberties we are using are the very thing that inflames and provokes those who would attack us.
David Frum,
we are here to defend that liberty by defending the higher level of surveillance seen since 9/11. Thank you,
David. And arguing against the motion, Bob Barr.
I promise not to use the example that David gave us of how easy it is for the FBI to screw up something as simple as interviewing the right person for a federal job, security clearance, as clear an example of why we should not entrust yet additional secret surveillance powers to the government. I promise not to make such an example. Better more domestic surveillance than another 9/11? I don't know how to put it quite delicately enough, and not just no, but hell no. The government doesn't need it. The government has shown it doesn't deserve it. The government has not justified it. The government will abuse additional domestic surveillance power, as sure as we are sitting here this evening, and the people of this great land and those who lawfully visit this country as well cannot afford it. Now, why can't we afford it? Many of us here, many of you all may be here this evening because you have a particular privacy concern, a particular category of information that you believe ought to be or continue to be private from government snooping, from government surveillance. Or you may not have a particular category of such information yourself, but others might, and you support them in maintaining the secrecy, the privacy, the privilege of maintaining that information for themselves. But I suspect that deep down, at least most of us are here this evening because we understand that privacy is more than simply the sum total of individual aspects of information that we want to retain private. Ayn Rand, that great philosopher who just 2 years ago, I believe it was, we celebrated the centennial of her birth, and that great proponent of freedom, put it perhaps best when she wrote in 1943, in the middle of World War II, in the Fountainhead, that privacy is the essence of civilization itself. Yes, it is that important. Civilization is the march of mankind toward a realization and an acceptance of and a protection of the basic right to privacy. I think our founding fathers understood that when they crafted the Bill of Rights. They didn't feel the need to mention in each one of those, this is a privacy right, but just look at them and you see the importance of privacy embodied in the foundation of the First Amendment. Were it not based on a notion that we have a right to the privacy of our religious, political views, for example, there'd be no reason to have the First Amendment. The Second Amendment, so much in the news these days, also is founded in essence on the notion of privacy. If we, as creatures of God, did not enjoy the inherent right to the privacy of our being, of our property, then there would be no reason to have a Second Amendment, which is designed to implement the protection of those ideas, those properties, those persons. The right to the privacy, the right to have your ideas, your privacy, your property, your person free from unwarranted government intrusion is indeed the essence of civilization. That's why it's so important that we address this issue. The question, better more domestic surveillance than another 9/11? Look at what we're talking about here. We're not talking about the legitimate function of government in a national security context to gather intelligence on foreigners, foreign intelligence. What we're talking about is our government surveilling us, and they ought to be held, and the Fourth Amendment requires them to be held to a very high burden. Why? Because our founding fathers recognized that if we allowed the government to intrude into our lives, other than in those areas where it has an articulable, legitimate need to pierce that sphere of privacy that surrounds each one of us, if we allow that, then we are not free. Think back. This question also talks about another 9/11. Fear, of course, the driving force for virtually every effort by the federal government and indeed by state and local governments since 9/11 to justify whatever expanded government power it is that they seek. But we're talking about another 9/11. Well, let's think about 9/11. Did 9/11 happen? Did those awful terrorists succeed on 9/11 in this very city and in our nation's capital? And in that field in Pennsylvania, did they succeed because the government was not able to increase its surveillance of those of us in this country? No. Those terrorists succeeded because of a series of tragic mistakes and blunders by government. Our government didn't use the tools that were already available to it. It could have stopped those terrorists at any number of points along their horrible journey. There were laws, repetitive laws, on the books at the federal and the state level to stop them from gaining access to the information that they needed, from gaining access to the tools whereby they carried out their horrible deeds. It wasn't because the government lacked sufficient power to surveil Americans. It is a false premise. And what has the government done since then? And what is it even doing now? I guarantee you, if this question, better, more domestic surveillance and another 9/11, is answered by the American people, not just here this evening, but writ large, then you will never, ever see the end of government surveillance power. Sort of like being a divorce lawyer, something I do not do. No matter how much you concede to the other side, they always want more. So it is with domestic surveillance. Even today, this administration, which has violated the laws limiting its ability to conduct domestic surveillance, it wishes and is seeking legislation to gain even more access to our private lives and, get this, the final irony, to grant immunity for past violations of the law. Better, more domestic surveillance and another 9/11, not on your life. Thank you.
Bob Arr, thank you. For the motion, Andrew McCarthy.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here this evening. My FBI story is a little bit different from David's. It's more along the lines of what the FBI was up against. My brother, who lived in the Bronx, was applying for a job with the FBI, and the knock we got on the door was from one of the neighbors, who told him that the feds had been by, but not to worry, he didn't tell him nothing. That, of course, was back in the 1990s, before there ever was a George W. Bush administration to bash. And during that time, the United States managed to stop exactly one terrorist attack by something other than dumb luck. That was the spring 1993 jihadist conspiracy against New York City landmarks, right here in Manhattan. How did we stop it? The FBI had a confidential informant who infiltrated the conspiracy. Now, think for a moment about how intrusive that is. Our government sent a man right out into radical mosques to meet with worshipers. All of them were Muslims. Several of them were American citizens. He prayed among them. He entered their very homes. He tape recorded all of his conversations. And following the government's instructions, he lied to them about who he was and who he was working for. And he did that precisely to trick them, in order to get them to compromise their most deeply held secrets and plans. And you know what? Neither the Fifth Amendment nor the Fourth Amendment had a thing to say about it. It's been the law of the United States for decades that such investigative techniques do not implicate our privacy and due process interests. As a result of that, there were no court orders for those tactics, no judicial supervision, no supervision of any kind for the most intrusive tactics imaginable. And had those tactics not been used, thousands of New Yorkers would have lost their lives in those attacks. That's not me conjuring up a nightmare scenario. That's not me trying to tap into your fear. That's a case that actually happened right down here in Manhattan. It's the kind of investigating that didn't happen before 9/11, when nearly 3,000 people were killed, and didn't happen in connection with most of the completed atrocities that were the subjects of the trials that took place in the 1990s. And the executive branch, without judicial supervision and without much congressional oversight to speak of, has intercepted and electronically eavesdropped on enemy communications in every war in the history of the United States since it's been technologically possible to do so. It's a simple fact. You cannot get good, actionable intelligence, the intelligence that saves lives, without monitoring what people are saying to each other, and without watching the bad guys to see who they speak to so that you can map out these organizations. That's just common sense. The most dangerous conspirators are, generally speaking, the most insulated conspirators. It takes wiretapping to ferret them out. In the 1930s, the government got Al Capone on tax evasion. That's all they could come up with. But in the 1990s, the government got John Gotti on about 25 homicides. How did they do it? They listened to what he was saying. They bugged his conversations. Today, of course, we're not talking about mafia hits. We're talking about mass murders of our citizens, not just law enforcement, but national security. All of our liberties are precious. On that, I think every panelist here is in agreement, as David said before. But none of our liberties is worthy of the name unless we can secure the country. And all our liberties are valuable, but none of them is as valuable as the collective right to life that belongs to all of us, collectively together in our national community. To protect that right, we have to do surveillance. We're fighting an enemy that does not have a territory to defend. It does not have a treasure that we can destroy them by taking. Our only defense is surveillance, finding out who they are, trying to figure out what they might strike next. And stopping them is far more important than prosecuting them. Prosecutions become cold comfort when the death tolls start to climb into the hundreds and the thousands, and we've seen that. That's not a scare tactic. Against such daunting risks, privacy interests fretted over by our friends on the other side are frankly trifles. What difference does it make if the government has information that your phone company, your bank, and every private vendor that you deal with not only has, but is warehousing and data mining, targeting you, but unlike the government, not targeting you so that they can protect you? The government's ability to access such information may make the difference between life and death. And in the national security context, that access is now subject to various judicial hurdles and congressional oversight, which our law has never imposed on prosecutors and agents who investigate such insignificant, relatively speaking, crimes as gambling. Common sense tells us that under the current threat, this is the kind of investigating that the government not only should be able to do, but must be able to do. If you don't think so, ask yourself about the security you willingly subjected yourself to without any court search warrant the last time you got on a plane or entered a public building or tried to carry a bag into Yankee Stadium, or even if you've had the experience of entering the offices of the American Civil Liberties Union. We had a trial here in New York about a year ago, and it came out during the trial that visitors to the ACLU's New York office are confronted when they come in with big signs on the wall that say, "Your bags are subject to search." Why do they do that? It's a reasonable balancing of minor intrusions to protect ourselves and the people we care about. That's what the Fourth Amendment has always been about, reasonableness. If there's a valid basis to believe people could be drinking and driving, the police can set up sobriety checks and stop motorists randomly. When the police arrest somebody, they've always had the ability to search them to make sure that they're not armed. If you work in a regulated industry, the government can compel you to provide information and even do spot checks. None of this requires a judicial warrant. None of it requires probable cause. And there are thousands of searches like this, countless searches, taking place in this country every day, and this has been the case for years and years, without any discernible suggestion that the Constitution has been shredded or that our core freedoms have been jeopardized. The thing all the exceptions I'm talking about have in common, besides being reasonable restraints on our freedom, is that none of them is nearly as important as protecting our national security, the safety of us all collectively. We've done a lot of talking about civil liberties these last 6 years,
wow.
But the conversations I remember the best are the ones that I had with victims of terrorist attacks, like the World Trade Center attack or the 200 mostly Muslim Kenyans and the people in the surrounding area who were victimized by the bombing of the U.S. Embassy in 1998 in Nairobi. The threat we're facing is not hype. It's flesh and blood real. And the fundamental rights of these victims, the right to life, the right to liberty, the right to pursue happiness, have been stolen from them by our enemies in a way that can never be compensated. Those are our most essential civil liberties. And the only way we can protect them is by enduring comparative trifles in order to let the government do the thing that we need it to do, the only thing we really need it to do, which is protect us and save lives. And that's why you should vote for the motion.
Very much. Against the motion, Jeffrey Rosen, to the podium, please.
No, I want my own. That ominous one is an Orwellian, an appropriate note for the evening. Congressman Barr has argued eloquently that more domestic surveillance of American citizens would not have prevented 9/11. I'd like to offer two additional reasons to try to persuade you to argue against the motion, better more domestic surveillance than another 9/11. The first has to do with effectiveness. It's possible to protect privacy and security at the same time. Possible, in other words, to reduce the risk of terrorism without dramatically increasing the surveillance of American citizens. And the second has to do with abuse. Mr. McCarthy talked about the comparative trifles, the minor incursions on privacy that were necessary since 9/11 to protect us. But in fact, history shows that every time the government has asked for and been granted broader powers of surveillance, it has not directed those expanded powers against suspected terrorists, but instead has used them to conduct dragnets, ineffective dragnets, that have menaced the privacy of innocent citizens without making us safer. What do I mean when I say that it's possible to protect privacy and security at the same time? I have in mind the evolution of a surveillance technology that some of you may have read about, and we can call this the naked machine, because this is more or less what it is. This is the high-tech, three-dimensional millimeter imaging machine that was initially used at a Florida airport a couple years ago to detect contraband. It can identify not only metal, but anything that's buried under clothing, ceramics or plastics. It's a very effective X-ray machine. The only downside is that it shows us completely stark naked. Now, the people who designed this machine came up with a simple programming shift. They found that it's able to maintain the pictures of the ceramics or the plastics and the contraband, but to take the pictures of the naked body and scramble it, scramble the anatomically sensitive regions into a nondescript blob. Now, obviously, this wonderful alternative, the blob machine, as opposed to the naked machine, is for many of us an act of mercy, especially for those of you this evening who are intelledating. You can invite each other afterward, come by and check out the blob machine, much safer than the naked machine. And it's also a silver bullet technology. It provides just as much security without any threat to privacy. It shows, in fact, that it's possible to protect our security without any, as it were, domestic surveillance. Now, I'm convinced that all of the laws and technologies that have been proposed since 9/11 can be designed in ways that look more like the blob machine than the naked machine. And it's sheerly willfulness that has led the other side to resist these well-designed laws and technologies for badly designed ones that menace privacy without making us safer. Let me try to persuade you by giving an example of the evolution of one of the most controversial and important surveillance programs since 9/11. This is the program that was originally known as Total Information Awareness. In its original incarnation, the government proposed to unite a lot of information that's held by public and private databases, magazine subscriptions, consumer records, internet browsing, to unite that with public arrest records, and then to conduct vast data mining that would try to predict whose travel patterns resembled those of the 9/11 terrorists and to stop those people at airports. Now, what was wrong with this system? It wouldn't have worked, and it posed grave threats to privacy. But aside from that, Mrs. Lincoln, it was an excellent system. Why would it have been ineffective? Well, if you imagine that the next attack looks nothing like the last one, it takes place, God forbid, on a train rather than a plane, then modeling the travel patterns of the 9/11 people will lead to the arrest of a lot of retired businessmen in Florida who take flying lessons, but will miss all the real terrorists. And given the huge numbers of false positives, the nation's airports would be brought to a halt. The second problem is privacy. The comparative trifles that Mr. McCarthy so sneeringly dismissed would have allowed the government to store in a centralized database all sorts of records that it could then use to menace its enemies, just as the Nixon administration did when it went after the tax returns of Vietnam protesters and threatened them with prosecution. Now, the evolution of total information awareness is a positive story and one that very much supports our side because of the opposition of a bipartisan coalition of libertarian conservatives like Congressman Barr and civil libertarian liberals like Professor Strossen, the system was refined. First, the government was prohibited from sharing information with law enforcement agents unless there was evidence of a serious crime or a violent terrorist act, avoiding that kind of discriminatory menacing of political enemies. And second, the government abandoned the foolish idea of trying to predict future attacks based on the patterns of past ones, and instead merely confirmed that people are who they say they are at the airports, a more modest goal, but one that makes us safer. What initially began as a naked machine technology evolved into a blob machine one, and across the range of laws and technologies, we can tell a similar story. So the trade-off that the other side falsely presents you with need not exist. Now, what about the abuse? It's clear that every time the government has been granted new authorities, it's abused them not to focus on suspected terrorists, but instead to menace innocent citizens. And this is not a surprise, because the essence of the Patriot Act, which was not a minor change in American surveillance laws, but a significant one in several respects, the government used to only be able to engage in warrantless searches in secret without notifying the people whose data was being searched if they could prove in advance that the target was a suspected spy or foreign terrorist. But because of the changes in the Patriot Act, the government is now able to engage in secret, warrantless surveillance of anyone's data merely by asserting that the data is relevant to a terrorism investigation. Should we be surprised when the FBI, using this new authority, issued not a couple of carefully chosen national security letters, but according to the Inspector General's recent report, 140,000 national security letters in the past 3 years? And according to his reports, most of those letters were not for suspected terrorists, but for people who had nothing to do with terrorism? And should we be surprised that that data was not a trifling threat to privacy, but was stored in centralized database and kept for 20 years? Should we be surprised that people who visited Las Vegas during a false terrorist threat had their hotel records and gambling records stored in that centralized database without their knowledge because of this foolish and misguided program? Or that the FBI, which couldn't even get David Frum's address right, was so inept that it didn't keep records of the national security letters that it issued and therefore didn't know when it was getting the right or wrong data? How could you possibly trust the government with expanded authority when it used the authority that was given so recklessly? The government's approach to this problem is much like that scene out of Midsummer Night's Sex Comedy, where Woody Allen suddenly comes up to Mia Farrow's window on a flying bicycle and says, "Hop on." And she's sort of skeptical, and she says, and he says, "Trust me, it's me, Andrew, hop on." She's still skeptical. He says, "Trust me anyway." This is the government's approach to this problem, "Trust me anyway," and we've seen too much of their abuse of this power since 9/11 to continue and engage in this trust. So we are saying not that it's not important to take the terrorist threat seriously, but we need meaningful oversight focused on genuine terrorists, which, while protecting the privacy of innocent citizens, we can do that through law, we can do that through through technology. We have in our hands the ability to protect privacy and security at the same time. What we need now is the will. Thank you very much.
Jeffrey Rosen, thank you very much. Arguing for the motion, John Yoo.
Well, I'd like to thank the Rosencrantz Foundation and Intelligence Squared for giving me the opportunity to escape the People's Republic of Berkeley and to visit a more conservative city like New York. I understand that many of you, according to the Washington Post, are here on dates. I think this is a wonderful idea. It's really remarkable to me because the last date I had was in the first Reagan administration. I do have to say, though, I find it surprising that many people would think that the voice and appearance of Bob Barr would be an aphrodisiac. First, let me directly engage with Jeff's point. If there are things that the government can do to increase security without reducing privacy, we should have already done them. I think at some point, though, and I think we're at that point now, you reach a trade-off. It's not unusual to security policy. Every government decision involves a trade-off. When we decide to reduce greenhouse gases by having higher mile per gallons requirements for cars, we know a certain higher number of people will die on the highways because the cars will be lighter. Government decisions always involve trade-offs. And it is possible to have trade-offs that go the wrong way. We have had periods where civil liberties were greater than they are today, and we have suffered as a result. So, for example, the wall that many of you may have heard about, which prohibited the FBI and the CIA from pooling their information about terrorist networks, is the one thing that the 9/11 Commission found that directly led to the 9/11 attacks. because we knew the names of two of the 9/11 hijackers inside the country. The agents who worked for the intelligence bureaus were unable to communicate that information to FBI agents inside the country who could have tried to locate them because of rules that were set up to protect civil liberties. Similarly, when we have tried to put Al-Qaeda members on trial before 9/11, and Mr. McCarthy was one of the prosecutors who did that, again, for civil liberties reasons, we turned over massive amounts of information to the defense teams. One of those was a list of all the co-conspirators of one of the Al-Qaeda suspects. If you think about it, that was a list of every single person at the time we thought was a member of Al-Qaeda. That list was found in Africa after the bombings in Yemen when our agents went out to try to find out who was responsible. I'm not saying that we should go all the way over security or all the way for civil liberties, but there is a balance and there is a trade-off. And having more civil liberties can have a cost of security, just as increasing security can have a reduction in civil liberties. Also, let me admit that in past wars, the government has reduced civil liberties, but I would say if you place it in historical perspective, those reductions of civil liberties are far greater than anything we're experiencing today. In 1798, the first war we fought as a country, it was made a crime to criticize the government during the war. In the Civil War, President Lincoln, on his own authority, detained thousands of American citizens in military detention without any recourse to civilian court and had many of them tried by military judges. In World War I, it was made a crime and people were prosecuted for criticizing the war effort, for arguing that people should not obey the draft. In World War II, President Roosevelt detained over 120,000 loyal American citizens. He initiated military courts, some of which were used to try American citizens. He ordered the warrantless wiretapping, not just of communications going in and out of the country, but every communication inside the United States, against a clear statute and Supreme Court precedent at the time, over a year and a half before Pearl Harbor. I think if you compare those measures that have been taken in wartime in American history in the past, the reductions in civil liberties we have today are nowhere near as large a level of magnitude. Take, for example, the political system. We have had one presidential election during this post-9/11 period. We have had several congressional elections. Political control of Congress just switched in the last election. We have had outpourings of new political speech through new methods and means. For example, people I wish never existed, bloggers. This did not exist before 9/11. Are we really in such a serious civil liberties crisis if bloggers are able to use this new medium to say, I think, quite incredible things? Take the detention policy that I'm sure the other side is going to talk about. These are always slippery slope arguments. How many American citizens have actually been detained since 9/11 in military detention? It's not the thousands or hundreds of thousands from previous wars. By my count, it's two. How many citizens of other countries in the United States, permanent resident aliens, have been detained as part of the post-9/11 program? Again, it's not thousands, it's not 100,000s. I think, again, that number is two. Take the NSA surveillance program that we've all heard about. Again, this is a program that every president in war has used, sometimes without judicial supervision, often without congressional authorization, often without the knowledge of anybody, in order to gain information on pending attacks. So when you try to take into account these factors, the gains of security, which I think we've had, and loss of civil liberties, how should you think about this problem? Let me close by making just a few points. First, have the expansions in government power been worth it? I would say yes. Look at the results. There have been no attacks since 9/11. And this is not because of luck. I think as even the 9/11 Commission report, the Silberman Robb report have said, as the administration and members of Congress have said, these expanded surveillance powers have resulted in the capture of Al-Qaeda members inside the United States and the prevention of plots. Since 9/11, the United States has succeeded in capturing or killing two-thirds of Al-Qaeda's leadership at the time of 9/11. Again, that's not just through luck. Second point, are civil liberties being permanently reduced? I think many thoughtful people say, yes, there's a trade-off, But I would be worried if we reduce civil liberties in wartime in a way that once the war is over, civil liberties are permanently reduced. There's no way for me to tell you what's going to happen once this war is over, but if you look at past American history, wartime has not produced a significant permanent reduction in civil liberties. Actually, if you look at the historical record, after war, we usually as a society experience our greatest growth in civil liberties. The Civil War saw the passage of the Reconstruction Amendments and the Emancipation Proclamation. World War II was followed by the War on Court. The last point, complacency, I think, is the real enemy. Even having this debate is a sign of the confidence we have that our system is working. But we should be aware that we're fighting a different kind of enemy, a non-nation state that conceals its activities as normal civilian communications, as normal civilian travel. The hard thing is, how as a society do we fight that, fight a war against an enemy who does not follow any of the rules of war and tries to disguise itself as one of us? I'll close by saying I think so far we have made a successful balance between civil liberties and security. We have reduced attacks and threats on the country. I think those gains have been worth it. And the question is, I think, for all of us today, is whether we would feel comfortable reducing the amount of government powers and, by doing so, give up some of the security we've bought at such a, I think, dear price since 9/11.
Thank you. And against the motion, Nadine Strossen.
Thank you very much. Andy, I hate to burst your bubble, but the reason why the ACLU is required to submit those who seek admittance to some kind of ID procedure is because we are only tenants in the building, and our strenuous objections were not well received by the landlord. And I have to tell you, just to illustrate how counterproductive or at least unproductive these kinds of pseudo-security measures are, ACLU lawyers were so distressed that we were subject, you don't have constitutional rights against a private landlord. They were so distressed that they were subjected to those measures that they would sign in under names such as Osama bin Laden and Mohammed Atta and had absolutely no problem. Stupid security. Bruce Schneider, one of the leading security experts in the country, says that what we have seen post 9/11 is security theater, not real security. I also feel that since we've had two FBI stories from David and from Andy, that I will tell my own FBI story, namely the former FBI special agent who is now working for the ACLU as a policy counsel, who did our extremely detailed analysis of the recent report by the Office of Inspector General about the massive abuses and fabrications and misuses of the national security letter and the lies that had been told about this to the public and to Congress. And this gets to the fundamental point of trust that has been raised on both sides here. Not, I don't mean to condemn the FBI as an institution or condemn particular individuals. I'm talking about human nature and political nature and official nature. The reasons why our founders had the genius of creating a system of checks and balances. And we are not saying that there should not be any monitoring or any surveillance at all. We are simply saying it should be done pursuant to the checks and balances that exist in the Constitution but have been completely ignored in so many post 9/11 measures. I welcome the spirit of collegiality in this program, and so in that spirit, I'm going to begin my argument against, or I should say continue my argument against the domestic spying and Big Brother type approach that the other side has been advocating by quoting someone whose policies they are defending, none other than President George W. Bush himself. In the president's very first public statement on that infamous date of September 11th, he hailed our nation as the brightest beacon of freedom in the world. And he vowed that no one will keep that light from shining. Well, ever since then, the ACLU has been working very hard to help the president keep that vow. It would be tragic if we let the terrorists terrorize us into abandoning the very ideals that they attacked. And that is the key reason why you must vote no on tonight's resolution, why more domestic surveillance is not better than another 9/11. Indeed, with more surveillance of the type that has been proliferating since 9/11, namely surveillance that is unjustified, unwarranted, unchecked, not to mention unconstitutional, with more of this kind of surveillance, the terrorists don't need another 9/11 to accomplish their goals. Of course, on that dreadful date, thousands of people were horribly killed, but their tragic deaths were not the terrorists' goal. Rather, they were a means to another, broader goal, to terrify all of us and to sabotage our country's democratic ideals of liberty and justice for all. Sadly, the terrorists have made great strides toward that goal through the original 9/11 attacks, actually, more accurately, through our own government's reaction to those attacks. That key point was well captured by some satiric but apt definitions from The Nation magazine's online dictionary of current political terminology. Here are its two definitions of Patriot Act, sad but true. The first one is the preemptive strike on American freedoms to prevent the terrorists from destroying them first. The second is the elimination of one of the reasons why they hate us. In my limited time, I can't respond to all of the misguided, misleading statements you have heard tonight from my, with all due respect to my opponents, but I'm going to start by briefly listing some of the major reasons for rejecting these kinds of measures. First, I want to reiterate that we are not opposing surveillance per se, but only surveillance that is not carried out in accordance with the Constitution's precepts. Many leading law enforcement and national security experts confirm that such constitutionally appropriate surveillance is at least as effective as the illicit post-9/11 measures. And let me quote one of them who's been very outspoken, Judge William Webster, who was director of both the FBI and the CIA under Presidents Reagan and Bush 1. Criticizing the sweeping post-9/11 measures. He said, from 1981 to 2000, the FBI prevented more than 130 terrorist attacks. We used good investigative techniques and lawful techniques. We did it without all the suggestions that we're going to jump all over people's private lives. We don't need to go in that direction. Second, the constitutional standards, in particular, the Fourth Amendment's core requirement of individualized suspicion, that is designed to preserve both safety and individual liberty. In contrast, too many post-9/11 surveillance programs are just overly broad dragnets, fishing expeditions. And that means, by definition, they are doubly flawed. On the one hand, they're sweeping in too much information about too many completely innocent individuals. And on the other hand, they are failing to hone in on the dangerous ones. As many critics have put it, the government is trying to find a needle in the haystack by adding more hay to the stack. My next point is that by scapegoating civil liberties, we are ignoring the more effective measures that would, in fact, according to national security experts and counterterrorism experts, be more effective as well as consistent with civil liberties. Since our opponents have referred to the 9/11 Commission report, I have to say that I read that report completely differently. Out of 41 specific recommendations of steps we should take to prevent another 9/11, almost none of them have anything to do with increasing the government's surveillance power. And unfortunately, according to the report with letter grades that was issued a couple of years after the initial recommendations, the government got D's and F's on most of the very significant concrete recommendations. So we have not exhausted those alternatives that would help to make us both safe and free. Unfortunately, the government now has gone in the opposite direction, and if we increase this kind of surveillance, we are going to have the worst of both worlds, because we will all be less free, but not more safe.
Thank you very much. And thank you to all our panelists for their opening arguments today. I'm now ready to announce the results of the pre-debate vote to see where this audience stands coming into tonight's debate. Before the debate, 41% of you voted for the motion, 37% voted against the motion, and 22% were undecided, rounding up all those numbers. So we're ready to begin the Q&A portion of the program. The idea is to mix up some of your questions, some of my questions, and someone on each side of the auditorium will come to you with a microphone, so please stand if you want to ask a question. We ask again that you please make your questions brief and refrain from giving speeches. Members of the press, if you're here tonight, please identify yourselves and your news organization, and members of the audience, you can opt out of that requirement. Mr. McCarthy, I'd like you to engage on a point, maybe with Bob Barr. You said that in an era of terror, that surveillance is the best defense that the country has. If, in fact, the war on terror is a war that is not finite, but a war that may last for decades, if not centuries, should the government's power in such surveillance be open-ended? Now, I'd like a quick response, and then if, Bob, you want to pick up on that very point.
Of course it should, because the purpose of the power is to prevent attacks, and as long as the threat of attack exists, it would make no sense to get rid of the power.
So this is not a wartime power. You're talking about permanent surveillance.
It's a threat-time power. It's an asymmetric war fought by a terrorist threat, and these measures are designed as much to thwart the threat as they are to prevail in the ultimate war.
Bob?
The current administration defines this war as unending, that is, perpetual. It defines it as entirely global, that is, the streets of Baghdad are as much a field for the commander-in-chief to operate in as the streets of Atlanta, Georgia, or New York City. And this administration believes that a president can don that mythical commander-in-chief hat whenever he or she feels like it, and therefore trumps any other power in the Constitution or law. That is the great danger here. The greatest tool with which the government ought to be equipped to avoid another 9/11 is not domestic surveillance, which is the topic at hand this evening, but better, more consistent gathering of foreign intelligence and tearing down the walls between one agency and another that have prevented and continue to stand in the way of effective use of that intelligence, that foreign intelligence.
John.
Chris, can you? Yeah. I just want to take issue with the underlying premise of your question and Bob's response, which is there's no reason to think the war on terrorism is going to be endless. There have been many wars between nation states and terrorists before, and they have ended. There have been wars in the United Kingdom, Italy, Germany, with terrorists, and they've all come to an end. I think the problem is that we call it the war on terrorism, so we think we're at war with everyone who uses terrorism as a tactic, which is not the case. We're at war with the Al-Qaeda terrorist organization and organizations that help it. And when we defeat that organization, the war will come to an end. It's not
one sentence. I mean, because I think what Bob Barr said is very important. Notice he said he's for enhanced foreign surveillance. But the moment that terrorist actually enters the United States, that's when the surveillance must stop, because I guess then he stopped being dangerous.
He's not saying that.
Nobody's saying that, David.
You want more surveillance
that.
Up to the point of entry.
I didn't say foreign surveillance.
No,
I said
more
foreign intelligence.
None of us are saying no surveillance. We're just saying subject to what kinds of oversight and what kinds of protections to make sure that not only is it consistent with individual liberty, but also that it's promoting of national security.
The opposite of more is less.
No, that's not true.
The balance.
It's more targeted, which means it will be more effective.
Okay.
The balance that we're arguing for is precisely the one that prevailed before the Patriot Act. And we're not taking issue with all of the Patriot Act, but with those provisions, mostly those dealing with national security letters and warrantless searches, that allow surveillance in secret merely by asserting that it's relevant to terrorism. The small reform that we're arguing for is to restore the pre-Patriot Act requirement that the suspect has to be a suspected spy or terrorist or his associates. And the administration, in rejecting that simple reform, has opposed sunset provisions and made clear that it wishes these changes to be perpetual. So John's notion that these will evaporate is inconsistent with the administration's determination to change domestic surveillance law forever.
My ears are ringing at this phrase, targeted. Because I will agree with you that many of the things the U.S. government does, including those bag searches, are stupid and pointless. But the precisely the reason that that everybody's toiletries and magazine reading is on display when you enter an airplane is in order to avoid targeting. That what the federal government has done since 9/11 is to have a very conscious decision that they're going to play, to use a sports analogy, they're going to play the players, they're not going to play the ball. And
David,
so we have this vast untargeted project precisely because organizations like the ACLU have opposed things
I'm
like trusted traveler programs.
I misunderstand our position. It depends what the basis is for targeting. Individualized suspicion based on what you do, not racial profiling based on who you are.
But the ACLU has opposed the trusted traveler program, right?
Law enforcement officials have agreed that demographic profiling is as ineffective as it is violative of individual rights because the terrorists can get around the profile very easily.
There's as many law enforcement officers who disagree with that as agree with it.
Well,
and your flat statement that the Fourth Amendment requires individualized suspicion is just wrong.
Okay, before we get too deep into the woods of the Constitution, I know we have some folks who have some questions, so if you're ready, there's somebody with a microphone standing by. So who do we have? A young woman in the back right there? Oh, I'm sorry, no, go ahead. Whoever gets the microphone first, please, you're on.
How do we have proof that someone's a terrorist until they commit a terrorist act?
Would you like to direct that to one side or one panelist?
Foreign intelligence law, since law was passed in the 1970s, presumes that there's a level of suspicion that stops short of probable cause that someone's committed a crime, but makes pretty clear that we think that this is a really bad person. And this was a balance that no one suggested caused 9/11. And what's so interesting about the other side is they're a failure to say that that standard is too high. There's no evidence that anyone wasn't the object of a FISA warrant because there wasn't a high enough degree of suspicion. They want to completely throw out individualized suspicion and have hundreds and thousands of warrants for people who just happened to show up at the airport. So this is not a subtle distinction, and we're convinced that by resurrecting that simple requirement, you could even broaden it a little bit. If you want to talk about the technical details, there have been thoughtful civil libertarians who have said you could have probable cause that someone's a suspected spy or terrorist or his or her associates. At least some connection to an identifiable, dangerous bad guy.
And
it's the dragnet searches that are threatening, and the other side has provided no justification.
Let's let the other side respond. John had a point here.
First of all, I think it's a great question because under the current law within the United States, as Jeff said, you need to have probable cause that someone's a terrorist before you can slap a wiretap on them. And it shows this fundamental confusion between how we think of terrorism. I think the other side thinks of it as a crime and is best handled through the standard criminal justice system, which is this probable cause approach. It makes a lot of sense when, as a society, we are willing to accept the harms of terrorism and retrospectively, after it occurs, then try to use the law enforcement system. What 9/11 showed us is that our government is trying to act prospectively to stop terrorist attacks before they occur. And in order to do that, we cannot rely on a system which says, prove to me that this person is already terrorist because of criminal actions they have already engaged in. Because at that point, usually, as we saw in 9/11, they're already dead, and there's no one to hold responsible in the criminal justice system.
As John himself knows, that is absolutely not the standard. It is much watered down. As Andy said, the court has not applied the strict Fourth Amendment probable cause requirement in this context, but required just some basis for suspicion. And let me tell you, the opposite danger, not only to individual rights, but to national security. The FBI has been complaining bitterly about this sweeping National Security Agency intercepts because it has led to countless hours of wasted time tracking down, quote, leads that lead nowhere, to dead ends. So again, the notion of honing in on somebody as to whom we have some basis for having suspicion is more effective from a security point of view as well as from an individual rights point of view.
Nadine is again demonstrating the difference between a law enforcement mindset and a criminal justice mindset. If you wait until you have probable cause that someone is an agent of a foreign power, you have waited too long. And that may be what the standard is in the criminal justice system. That may be what's appropriate in the criminal justice system. But the Fourth Amendment has never required that. What the Fourth Amendment requires is that searches be reasonable. And if our goal is going to be to stop terrorist acts rather than to bring people to justice, that has to be the standard that we deal with. And we have to do it with an intelligence mindset, which is far different from the criminal mindset. When the FBI investigates a crime, they expect to bat about 900. They expect that most of the time when they conduct an investigation, they're going to get their man, and they're going to successfully prosecute him. Intelligence doesn't work that way. If you hit one for 15, you're probably doing well. But it's chasing the needle in the haystack that intelligence is about. And if you're going to apply criminal justice standards to that task, you're finished.
How about three out of 153,000 to
let's
use
move
the NFL
off this
numbers.
Point just for a few seconds. Do we have another question? Yes, sir, from the audience right there on the end. Yes. There you go.
This is a question for the people against the motion. Would you, any of you feel the slightest bit differently about this proposition if you either trusted the administration or felt that they were competent in the performance of their duties?
We took exactly the same position as did Bob Barr with respect to the last so-called Anti-Terrorism Act under the Clinton administration. And I do have to say that the opponents here are completely ideologically neutral and very diverse. Libertarians, civil libertarians, join forces with a lot of conservative organizations that really are committed to reducing government power over our private lives. And it's because the impulse of government is necessarily to increase its power, regardless of what their politics are. We had a long litany from John Yoo about past administrations, including some human rights heroes in other contexts, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Abraham Lincoln. In a wartime situation, they all react the same way, which is to expand their power to the constitutional limit and beyond. And in 2020 hindsight, we look back and we see that none of those measures did anything to add actual protection to our national security.
Nadine, what about the common sense argument advocated by the other side that Americans are more than willing to give up some liberties, whether they're going to a Yankee game or whether they're going through the airport security? Do you see a fundamental difference between that and surveillance on the part of the government?
I think the common sense argument, speaking for myself, and also it's actually reflected in constitutional doctrine, is that no freedom is absolute, except probably the freedom to think and to believe, which stays entirely within your heart, head, and soul. But in acting in the real world, no right is absolute. It's just that government has a heavy burden of justification. It has to show that the restriction is going to be effective in actually making you safer, and that nothing that is less violative of your rights would be as effective. And think about it. Of course, most of us would be willing to give up some liberty if that was the price to pay to bring about security. But how many of us would be willing to give up liberty without gaining security in return? Is that common sense? Or to give up more liberty than we have to in order to get the same amount of security?
Well, how about this proposal? What if we were to say, why don't we let not only people choose, but let each person make their own individual choice about how much they personally were prepared to do? For example, if you want to fly, you can have a shorter line if you're prepared to let the airline know more about you, and a longer line if you're prepared to know that we could each make our choice. And civil liberties groups have consistently fought and fought and fought when American Airlines has been promising this now for 3 years. And we could let the market decide, and you could be in the long line, and I'm happy to let them know how long I've been in my present abode and how many kids I have, and I'll go in the short line.
And I have no illusion, as somebody who flies a couple hundred thousand miles a year and has no desire to die that way, I have no illusion that that would do anything other than save me time. I have no illusion that would make me safer. How many of the 9/11 terrorists had valid IDs? How many of them would have sailed through and been treated as trusted travelers themselves?
They had fake driver's licenses, many of them under...
That would have been enough to get them there. Every security expert says that this is false, gives us a false illusion of security.
You'd have to give them a little bit more than a driver's license. You'd have to give them a whole battery of information. And the airlines, under the threat of litigation...
Ask any teenager about how easy it is to get a false ID.
Okay, so the point is, your answer is no. We will not let people make that individual choice. We will not allow airlines and their customers as private actors to say, let's put this to a truly personal individual trade-off test.
Well, we're not talking about market choices. You can't opt out of a database with 100,000 people in it. And obviously, people react intuitively to the place where the security hits them. So if they have to wait a little longer, they'll make the trade-off.
The so-called security.
But what we're talking about here are fundamental changes in laws and technologies that make it impossible to escape from dragnet and ubiquitous surveillance and transform the very nature of society. And this is something, just as in environmental law, where market choices are completely inadequate. And that's why constitutional values, whether or not you think that this stuff is required by the Constitution, are implicated.
But Jeffrey, doesn't that argue for what the proponents are saying, that the technology has changed so much, and you have government agencies who are mining hundreds of thousands of communications in literally nanoseconds? Doesn't that make it almost impossible for probable cause, warrants, and court orders to get at this information?
It makes it easier. You don't have to show up at a magistrate's office and read a warrant in person. You can email or BlackBerry a request to a secret court which could grant it immediately. Or you could have programmatic warrants that would say this broad category of person looks suspicious. There's great familiarity in foreign intelligence surveillance law in dealing with broad categories of data mining and so forth. What's unprecedented about the Patriot Act, and what the previous question smoked out is that much of the Patriot Act was actually proposed by the Clinton and Bush administration after Oklahoma City and opposed by the same heroic bipartisan coalition led by my colleagues that are less successful after the 9/11. But it would be, they've provided no reason for why that framework wouldn't be just as effective. You could have broad surveillance, it just wouldn't be unlimited, and the unlimited surveillance is ineffective and threatens privacy.
We've got about 5 minutes left in the Q&A, so we have some questions. Yes, sir,
This is really addressed to the panel against the motion, but what seems to be missing in your argument is a lack of addressing the nature of the threat. The threat, it seems to me, is that our terrorists today have technology too, and they have a technology that affects the existential nature of our society. And don't you believe that there should be at least some moderation in your point of view and flexibility relative to the threat that you're confronting? So that it's one thing to protect individual rights when a relatively limited threat exists. But when you're talking about an existential threat to the nation, to millions of people, don't you have to suspend, at the very least, this firm, rigorous approach? That's my question.
The threat to our nation at the time the Bill of Rights was drawn up and adopted by this nation was far greater than the threats we face today, I dare say. We faced at the time the very protections against unlimited government intrusion that are embodied, for example, in the Fourth Amendment, were such that the very existence of our nation was clearly threatened by the greatest military power on the face of the earth. Not a handful of cells, but a military power that could wipe us off the face of the earth as a sovereign nation, that is Great Britain. In the face of that overwhelming threat, our founding fathers understood that the answer to your question is no. Government should not, even facing the most dire threat to this nation, allow, or the people should not allow government, even facing that level of threat, to invade their privacy without a sufficient reason. And indeed, there is great flexibility that you mentioned already embodied in the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Great flexibility. There is tremendous flexibility built into the Patriot Act already. And yet the other side is arguing, by the terms of the question here this evening, is that insufficient, and should government have essentially unfettered power? And the answer to that should be no, the same as it was no in the 18th century, when these very precious mechanisms for guaranteeing our inherent rights were crafted.
John, I think I'd like you to respond to that, because you were instrumental in crafting mm-hmm. the administration's legal opinion on mm-hmm. that very point about mm-hmm. whether the president could go beyond the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court and without any warrants at all mm-hmm. eavesdrop not only on the foreign agents but on people inside the United States.
There are two things going on here. First of all, with the Patriot Act, which is not the focus of your question, but I think it's the focus of your question, there is a system of secret courts and secret evidence that issue secret warrants for secret wiretaps. That system was created in 1978. The Patriot Act amended some of those provisions, but the basic structure is one that we have been happy to live with for almost 30 years. And so this claim that the Patriot Act was this huge revolution, I think, is mistaken. The second thing I would say is, in terms of the ability of the president to go beyond the Patriot Act, that's based on history. As I said, every president, and as Andrew said, every president from Woodrow Wilson on used exactly those same authorities when confronted by a foreign attack or a foreign threat. We're not arguing here for unfettered power. We're not arguing that these powers ought to be used in peacetime. We're not arguing that these powers ought to be used to catch common criminals. I actually personally don't think any evidence from those surveillance programs should be entered into court in any kind of criminal prosecution. They are there to try to prevent a future attack. And it seems, and this is really David's key point, it seems weird, right? If you're outside the United States and you're a terrorist, the NSA has unlimited ability to track you. You don't have to go to a court and get a warrant to surveil Osama bin Laden. If Osama bin Laden were to move to the United States, then a whole system of court-ordered procedures are required under the other side's framework. That is a perverse and exactly reverse incentive to the one we should be creating.
Let's not exaggerate court-ordered procedures from a court that has almost never denied anything the government has asked for in a secret proceedings, which also has the power, and the government has the power to engage in surveillance before getting a court order. But, John, the most striking thing in your answer was your statement that these, to quote John Ashcroft, had a different view. He described the Patriot Act as giving the government sweeping new surveillance powers. That was his exact quote.
I'm not defending Ashcroft today.
Well, he had a different view of the scope of this law. And
I did, but it wasn't pleasant. And I certainly would never have been promoted to speechwriter.
And you know that the government has shown that it has used most of those sweeping new powers in ordinary criminal cases, fraud, gambling, drug crimes. I'm not condoning any of those crimes, but isn't it interesting to hear you say that you oppose the way it has mostly been used, in fact?
I don't think it's – the NSA wiretapping program has not been used to prosecute garden variety crime. I
mean,
We're talking about
the Patriot Act. Remember, the NSA went beyond and around and underneath the Patriot Act.
Most of you – I thought you all just said the Patriot Act was something – most of which you supported, some of which you didn't. But I thought we were talking about the NSA wiretapping program, where there is a very clear distinction about what that evidence can be sought for. It's not to be used for criminal prosecutions, and as far as I know – It never has been used for criminal prosecutions.
We don't know what it's been used for because it's been entirely secret, and the government has refused to tell us what it is.
Well,
but we do know that the evidence from the national security letters has been used in ordinary criminal prosecutions. In fact, the Inspector General found that there had been at most 2 terrorism-related convictions, but about 30, which was out of 140,000 letters, only 30 other criminal convictions for crimes that had nothing to do with terrorism. I have to say, the gentleman earlier asked, would you give up nothing? I would make a deal with John. He says, give us this broad, warrantless surveillance power, but we can only use it for intelligence, and we can't introduce it in criminal prosecutions. I would take that deal. That's a deal that the Germans have struck. They allow broad intelligence powers, but it can't be used for prosecutions. And for me, that's an example of the thoughtful balancing of privacy and security that allows us to have both at the same time. But every time the administration has been presented with this deal, it has been completely adamant, has refused to make those sensible trade-offs, and that's why you have to vote against their position.
Just about 20 seconds left, and it sounds on the face of it like a reasonable deal.
It's the law of the United States. It's long been the law of the United States that if agents are searching for a legitimate reason, if they have lawful reason to be searching what they're searching, you can use that evidence even if it's not what they were looking for in the first place. Now, I'm not saying that it's not the possibility of a reasonable compromise, but the suggestion that it's an unreasonable position not to want to negotiate that I just have to disagree with that.
Andrew, thank you very much, and that ends the discussion portion of our evening. And now we're going to have the final remarks from our panelists, beginning with the side opposing the motion. And panelists for this, if you just please stay seated. You'll each have 2 minutes to make your closing statement, and we'll start speaking against the motion. Bob Barr.
Thank you. I had the opportunity in April of 2000 to testify before the House Intelligence Committee on the issue of whether or not the National Security Agency, or NSA, engaged in or should engage in electronic surveillance of U.S. persons within the United States without court order. My position was that the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which is the law of the land, required warrants in such instances. There was another gentleman that testified that very same day on the very same issue, General Mike Hayden, at the time head of the NSA. Now, another star on his shoulders, four on each side, head of the CIA. He testified that day, according to Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, if in fact our government deems it appropriate or necessary to conduct electronic surveillance of a U.S. person in this country, the government is required to, always has, and will secure a court order, because that is the law of the land, and the NSA obeys and abides by the law of the land. Strange. That law, in its operative parts, remains the law of the land today. Yet that same man now takes a very different attitude. There's been no declaration of war. What has changed is simply the perception that now, because of 9/11, the president can order those under him to violate the law because he deems it appropriate and necessary in his perception of his role as commander-in-chief. The fact of the matter is, folks, we are a nation that has a Bill of Rights. It cannot be and should never be allowed to be trumped by those seven words that the president serves as commander-in-chief. The Bill of Rights is the Bill of Rights. It prevails.
Bob Barr.
And the sense of privacy that it protects ought not to be frittered away by granting the government yet more power in addition to the vast power that it already has.
Thank you for your closing remark. And in his final rebuttal, arguing for the motion, David Frum.
I want you to note, as you think about how you're going to vote, both the abstract and the radical character of the arguments of the people on the other side. They're abstract in that they have not given you one example of what you yourselves as individuals ought to be afraid of. What is this tremendous incursion? And I ask you as you think about this to think, do I feel less free to speak my mind? Do I feel that there are secrets that are important to me that are more in danger of exposure now than there were before? And then I ask you to consider, how many terrorist attacks have there been on U.S. soil since 9/11, and what is the terrible record through the 1990s, from the first attack on the World Trade Center in 1993 to the attack in 2001. I want you also to notice how radical their claim is. We are not debating that better limitless surveillance, better surveillance at the sole discretion of the president, better lawless surveillance. What we are saying is better the higher level of surveillance that has prevailed since 9/11 than this risk. Better more. Their argument is completely is not modulated. It is not balanced. It is to say that nothing. There is to be no more. I sometimes think, as I've been listening to this argument, what would they have said had they been present at the introduction of the stop sign? They would have looked at it and said, this is the first step on the slippery slope toward the total abolition of motion. No one will ever be able to go anywhere ever again. What we are debating here is more and less. We are debating balance. I think that when we identify, as we surely will, specific problems and abuses that have appeared since 9/11, they ought to be fixed. Of course they ought to be fixed. And that is why the original Patriot Act was sunsetted. That is why Congress has oversight powers. Of course those things must be addressed. But what we must do this with an understanding of danger. We must ask ourselves, when we look back at that world before 9/11, when people in the same agency were not even allowed to talk to each other about what they knew, is that where we want to return to?
David Frum, thank you.
Thank you.
And against the motion, Jeffrey Rosen.
We don't need lectures on radicalism from the other side. This was the administration, led by our distinguished opponents, who argued that the president has the unilateral authority to ignore or reinterpret laws, including the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Law, with which he disagrees because it infringes his power as commander-in-chief. And this is the administration that has indeed used the broad and sweeping new and radical powers that it's been granted, which were a warrant for unreviewed, limitless surveillance by the FBI in ways that had nothing to do with terrorism. They are the radicals. Our position is the traditionally conservative position. We merely want to restore the law as it was before the Patriot Act. We're willing to engage in the kind of sensible compromises that came out in the debates. We are not uncompromising at all in this regard, but we want to avoid a transformation in American liberties from which the country might never recover. David Frum asked for a specific example. I'm happy to provide one and to close with one, and that's the example of Britain. Britain, the cradle of Western democracy, was the country that wired itself up in the 1990s with so many surveillance cameras that it now resembles the threat of the set of the Truman Show. This was defended as a way of stopping IRA terrorism, but the cameras are now used for very different purposes. They're used to charge a car tax for every car that comes into the city, and recently we learned microphones have been set up in city centers to have ominous voices warning people when they're getting drunk in public. I experienced a society that had microphones and surveillance cameras, and that was in Warsaw in 1988, right before the fall of the Berlin Wall. And the British public is indifferent to statistics showing that there is no connection between the spread of the cameras and the decline or prevention of violent crime or terrorism. So these things are indeed small incursions, and even free societies can transform themselves incrementally in ways whose effects are only beginning to be understood. And in a world where it's possible to track people from door to door and to store that in ubiquitous databases, ubiquitous surveillance that might make it possible to see where I get up in the morning, which subway I take, and
Jeffrey,
where I end up going to work is not an Orwellian impossibility, but a very real probability. And we ask you to resist it by voting against the motion.
Jeffrey Rosen, thank you. In his closing thought for the motion, Andrew McCarthy.
With due respect to the other side, what you're hearing is radical. We now have increased surveillance. We've had it since 9/11. I don't think it's sweepingly increased surveillance, but it's certainly increased surveillance beyond what we had in the 1990s. What they're telling you is better another 9/11 than increased surveillance. Now, this is New York. Ask yourself, what have you been going through for the last 5 years, 6 years, whether it's keeping you up at night that the government is frittering away with your personal information or whatever else it is that is the grave concern here, and ask yourself if that's anything like what 9/11 was like, and whether in a million years you would ever want to go through anything like that again if you could instead deal with the kinds of trade-offs between liberty and security that we've had in the last 6 years. That's not even a contest. And to say that it is, that's about as radical as anything I can imagine. Now, one of the last thing I'd like to address is this idea of perfect security and risk of error. Investigation, whether it's law enforcement national security is a human process, and we are not going to be able to repeal human error. There are going to continue to be errors. There are going to continue to be roguish acts by people who are rogues. Rogues are going to be rogues no matter what the rules are. When you change the rules, when you clamp down on what your agents are able to do, what you're actually clamping down on are the good faith people who you didn't need to worry about in the first place. These powers are in place because they're needed to ferret out potential threats, because there is no perfect security. We can wire the whole place up with cameras and bugs and the like,
Andrew.
But we can't prevent every attack.
Thank you. Andrew McCarthy, thank you. And her closing thought, Nadine Strossen.
I'm afraid that Andy has not understood our position at all. Our position is that more surveillance of the sweeping, random, mass dragnet type we are complaining about, and security experts are complaining about post 9/11, is not going to prevent another 9/11. And in fact, not only is it ineffective, but it is actually counterproductive to the security goal, because it is deterring and diverting resources from measures that the security community has a consensus would be more effective. Let me give you a couple specific examples. The mass gathering of data about all of our communications. The government tells us it's going to engage in data mining. Sounds really impressive, doesn't it? Of course we would like to believe it would work. Well, you know who knows that it doesn't work? Security experts and computer experts. Let me quote one. Professor Farley at Harvard University, who is a science fellow at Stanford Center for International Security, complaining from a security perspective about the NSA domestic spying program, he says it is based on a false assumption that you can work out who might be a terrorist based on calling patterns. But guilt by association is not just bad law, it's also bad mathematics. Security theater, not real security. And you know, we put in place, understandably, the Patriot Act, NSA domestic spying, shortly after 9/11. Government officials, to their credit, wanted to do something to at least make us feel more secure. But you can't do anything meaningful until you have looked at what the actual causes were of that horrible catastrophe on 9/11. And that kind of analysis was not done until much later by the Joint Intelligence Committees of both Houses of Congress and by the Bipartisan Citizens Commission. And they did not recommend the kind of mass surveillance measures that have been advocated by our proponents. And in fact, again, the common sense, concrete steps that all of us blithely assume have been taken have not, in fact, been taken. John Yoo said, well, we've already done all of that. Well, that's not what Tom
Nadine?
Kaine thinks, the chair of the 9/11 Commission. He says it is scandalous that police and firefighters in large cities still cannot communicate reliably in a major crisis. We oppose
Nadine
the Strossen. Resolution because it is bad for security and freedom.
Thank you. And now, batting cleanup for the proponents, John Yoo.
Well, first I want to apologize for the lack of rhetorical skills on at least my part. That should not prevent you from voting for our side in the debate. I've just admired the rhetorical gifts of everyone else on the panel. And that, from what I can tell, that it consists of calling the other side radical and exaggerating what they actually want to do in the real world. Clearly, I'm not an expert this. I did not get the note about the dark suit, which is really the only thing I noticed listening to everybody's discussion. Two things. One is I think the other side fundamentally confuses war versus crime. Ask yourself this. If the Soviet Union had carried out the 9/11 attacks in exactly the same way, exactly the same people, would we not be at war? And wouldn't we not be justified using wartime measures to try to stop al-Qaeda from carrying out a second attack? Why is the fact that they are not a nation state require us to go back to a criminal justice system, the pre-9/11 world? The second thing I'll just say is it's an empirical question whether the security of our country has gone up in response to the increased surveillance measures. I think that has. There's the person who wanted to blow up the Brooklyn Bridge. There's too many bees there, so I'm not good at this. The guy who wanted to blow up the Brooklyn Bridge was caught only because of these new measures.
that guy who wanted to carry out terrorist attacks in Florida and Southeast America, the United States, who fled the country, he was only identified and an alert went out only because he was identified through his expanded surveillance techniques. So there's still more we can do. One thing I would like to do is end as we began. I think the FBI is utterly incompetent. It's because they try to do drug dealing, white-collar crime, which I'm sure is of interest to many of you in New York, and all kinds of other things, and counterterrorism. The reason we keep them all together is out of civil liberty concerns. I would say let's get rid of the FBI, create a real national security counterterrorist agency, and let the states and the states control drug crimes, white-collar crimes, and get the FBI out of the job of trying to do bank robberies and kidnappings. I think that makes no sense. That's an improvement we can make, but would require you to vote for our side.
And right on time. You like that. That concludes the closing arguments. Now it's time for you, the jury, to vote once again. So look for that keypad, the thing that looks like a calculator, on your armrest, this thing right here. And we're not going to confuse you by changing the code at this late stage. You may be confused enough. I don't know. So, after my prompt, please press 1 if you are for the motion, press 2 if you are against the motion, or 3 if you are undecided. 1 for, 2 against, 3 undecided. Please go ahead and press your buttons now. We need a little Jeopardy music here. Dun, 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 dun. I want to thank the debaters and audience for their participation tonight. And before I announce the results of the final vote to see who has swayed whom, we need to take care of some business. First, the next Intelligence Squared U.S. debate will take place on Wednesday, May 16th, here at the Asia Society and Museum. The motion to be debated next month is Beware the Dragon, a Booming China Spells Trouble for America. Sounds like a good one. Unfortunately, the debate is sold out. But the good news is that packages for the fall 2007, spring 2008 series are on sale right now, online and by phone. So avoid disappointment and buy those series packages now. Tonight's debate, by the way, can be heard locally on WNYC AM 820 on Friday, April 27th at 2 p.m. And some point after that, it will be heard on hundreds of NPR stations across the country. No exaggerations. Copies of some of the panelists' books are for sale upstairs in the lobby. And I think, David, you've got a book out, right? And John has got a book, and Jeffrey. So at least three of our War by Any Other Name, is that it? Something like that?
Just the white book. Oh, buy the white book.
So if you want to help out our panelists in another way, buy their books upstairs. You can also purchase DVDs from previous debates here tonight or from the Intelligence Squared U.S. website. And finally, please be sure to pick up, it sounds like we're selling things here, doesn't it? Please be sure to pick up a copy of tomorrow's edition of the Times of London and the Times Literary Supplement as you leave the auditorium, but I think those are free. And now, what we have all been waiting for after our debaters worked so hard to sway you, you decided, after the debate, 39.5% were for the motion. So a bit of a movement toward your direction. After the debate, 55.6% were against the motion. So that's and undecided. This shows you how good our panelists were. Undecided, less than 5%. So, congratulations. Which means that those against have carried the day. So our sincere appreciation for you to being a wonderful audience, and thank you, panelists. We appreciate it. Thanks. Thank you.